Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jason Randall, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Moving Water, a Fly Fisher's Guide to Current. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jason Randall about Moving Water, a Fly Fisher's Guide to Current. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Before we introduce Jason, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Jason's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Jason's book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Current. Thanks to Stackpole Books for providing that copy, and here's how you can win it. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question's going to be about something that Jason and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you can win Jason's book. Tonight our guest is Jason Randall. Jason is a veterinarian certified in fish health and medicine. He is also a member of the World Aquatic Veterinary Medical Association and the Society for Freshwater Science. He has been an outdoor writer for the last 10 years with articles appearing regularly in American Angler, Eastern Fly Fishing, and many other outdoor magazines. His first book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, was released in 2012 by Stackpole Books. It studies the effect of current on trout, their prey species, and presentation, where vertical layers of current create drag and requires adjustments to improve nymph fishing success. His second book, Feeding Time, A Fly Fisher's Guide to What, Where, and When Trout Eat, was released in August of 2013. Its focus on matching your fishing strategies to the trout's feeding strategies, especially when targeting large trout, because if you know the 5W questions for large trout feeding, who, what, when, where, and why, you can catch them regularly. Well, Jason, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, good to have you. And we got a lot of, as you said before we got on the show here, a lot of ground to cover tonight. And who thought there was so much to talk about in the way of currents and rivers, but we've got a lot to talk about.
Boy, there is. You know, if the more we know about current and not only the way it defines the rivers affecting trout, their habitat, their prey species they feed upon, but it also affects our presentation and how we can catch more fish.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's always something we're fighting against. Either it's too fast, it's too slow, it's going the wrong direction.
Right.
It's always something.
That's true. You know, I think by understanding the currents and the way trout interact with it and how they adjust to current, you know, we can improve.
Well, let's dig right in here. You start your book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents. You start the book talking about the lotic system. What is a lotic system?
Well, a lotic ecosystem is the aquatic-based ecosystem that's defined by current. It's characterized by the unidirectional movement of water, as opposed to like a lentic system ecosystem where it's a still water habitat like a pond or perhaps a lake, something like that, or other marine ecosystems where there's movement of water like tides that come in and go out, but it's not a unidirectional movement of water. Estuarial type habitats and marine habitats have movement of water, but it's both directions.
So what are some of the key characteristics, then, of a lotic ecosystem?
Well, I mean, think of the river or stream, current, and with all the implications that that has. Current is actually the defining hallmark of lotic ecosystems. It really dictates the entire ecosystem. Every organism that lives in the stream has made adjustments, modifications, or adapted behaviors to the presence of current. Some subspecies from aquatic vegetation to, more complex vertebrate species have made some compensation for current. Either they like it or they don't, and they distribute themselves accordingly.
Okay. You talk in your book about temporal and spatial variations. What is that, and how does it affect us as fly fishers?
Well, variation, obviously it means change, and it really is a key feature of rivers. They're constantly changing, remodeling. Temporal variation means that the river we encounter each time we visit is different, in fact, from the last time we maybe visited the same river. I think it was Heraclitus that said that no man ever steps into the same river twice, for it's not the same river. I think he goes on to say that the man is not the same man either, but to complete the quote. But it really addresses the changeable nature of rivers. Spatial variation means that one section of the river is completely different from another. Think of a riffle and the characteristics that you notice there and the organisms and how they're affected that live in a riffle or a run. And then look at a flat water or a pool where the current may be slower or negligible, and it's an entirely different habitat.
Yeah, we just went, as we were talking before the show, I spent a lot of time in Boulder, Colorado, and then half the time up here in Bailey, Colorado, but Boulder really got hit, with this last flooding and so forth. And talking about changes, now the rivers cut new areas. They're even talking about a town there in Jamestown where they might not even rebuild it because the river has changed course so much because of the flooding. So it's we have totally new riverbeds.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a river can cut an entirely new channel. And think of like a fast, high-flowing river and how much effort it must be to turn a river like that around a bend and the pressure that must create on the outer bank of that river, the erosion. And you think of, why rivers meander, why they loop back and forth, but a lot of times that's carved out during high flows as river bends are widened and accentuated and the river tends to meander back and forth. And during floods, it can completely change course and you can end up, over the course of a long time, with a canyon as wide as the Grand Canyon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's taken millions of years to do.
Right.
But it is amazing what can happen in a few hours as well.
Oh, definitely.
which is what we experienced here in Colorado, where just what you were talking about, the river going around a bend and eating out underneath the roadways, and then the roadways collapsing.
Oh, yeah. And how many times have you gone back to the river the next year and there's a new deadfall or a new tree in the water, and maybe there's a whole gravel bar that's accumulated behind that tree in a very short period of time, and it's changed your favorite fishing hole, completely and redistributed trout, and, it's never going to fish the same.
Yeah, we always do that when we're running rivers, it's always scouting the rapids, no matter how many times you've run that rapid before, you want to scout it, because just like you said, there could be a log in the middle of it now that wasn't there yesterday, so constantly changing.
There was a riffle that we used to have in the Pere Marquette River in central Michigan, and there was a log that was sitting there for, 4 or 5 years. So we used to call it beer log. it was a shallow little strip of water, and it was a perfect place to sit down and grab a beer out of the cooler on a hot afternoon. And then one year we got there, and it was gone. It was this huge, massive log was swept away in the spring floods.
Yeah, yeah. So you never know. Like you say, it changes every time.
Yeah.
Well, we've also got some other things going on that affect those changes. Regional climate, and the influence of the watershed itself on the stream or river. You want to talk a little bit about those and what we're looking at there?
Yeah, you think of like a high desert river that only flows during the rainy season maybe, or one that's a constant flow maybe from a melting glacier. But probably the best illustration I came across that, you know, made an impression on me was fishing in the state of Washington near Seattle. My wife and I went up into, you know, kind of the high mountain streams in the Cascades with Dave McCoy, guide out in that area, and a delightful time fishing these little plunge pools from a very narrow little mountain stream that had just gorgeous clear water and beautiful. We caught these little tiny native West Slope cutthroat trout on an elk hair caddis. It was a delightful day, and it was cool and kind of a little misty. But if we drove maybe 2 hours west to Ellensburg, Washington, and fished the Yakima River, which is just that short of a distance away, we're fishing a very arid climate. The water temperatures were much higher, and boy, does that change the whole ballgame. I mean, you're looking at an entirely different climate. You know, the trout are completely different in their behaviors and patterns of feeding and their distribution within the river, and we were struggling to catch a few fish. It was hot, and we were sweating, and we found some shady, deeper water and pulled a few fish out, but completely different river 2 hours away.
Yeah, I guess that's what we like about fly fishing as fly fishers is the constant challenge. It's never the same.
That's true. That's what keeps us coming back. I guess if it was as easy as golf, we'd all probably get bored.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, even when you go out with a guide that fishes the water every day, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And you watch them on days struggle. And they know where every, you know, seemingly know where every fish in that river is.
It's funny how we take heart from that kind of thing, too. You know, it's like, well, you know, it happens to all of us.
Yeah. Well, you also talk about the difference between meandering streams and riffle pool streams and the different profiles you've got there. How does the current differ in those streams? I mean, don't all streams meander? All streams have riffles?
They do, but they're entirely different streams, and it's really based on how the water erodes the stream bed and banks and how that dictates the course of the river. A riffle pool type of stream is usually a high-altitude stream with a hard bottom, and usually that water kind of follows the path of least resistance, but the erosion pattern is quite different from a meandering stream that usually would typically be in a lower area, more in the valley floor rather than in the high mountains. It has a softer bottom, and the erosion pattern tends to create meanders that loop back and forth rather than riffle pools, which, you know, are areas where the river speeds up, erodes the environment, and then empties in and discharges into a pool. The meandering streams are slightly different in the fact that usually the bank of the bend, the outer bank of the bend, is going to be the deepest point of the river, and then as it crosses over to go into the next meander that loops back, usually you have what's called a crossover rapids, as the erodible material that was picked up and excavated in the river bends are distributed throughout the straightaway section between loops. So you end up finding most of your riffles in meandering rivers are in the straight sections between loops, and then the deepest part of those rivers are usually in the outer bank of the bends.
And where? How does that affect where the fish lie?
Well, that's an interesting point, because if you think of erosion at the river, outer bank of the river bend, not only does it excavate, you know, rubble and gravel and material and carry it a short distance to deposit in the riffles, but it also excavates food, you know, grain fly larvae that burrow into, you know, the softer soil, of terrestrial worms that are there are excavated in that process. And then usually that straightaway section is where that food is carried. So the straightaway section, the initial head of the riffles, is a great place to find trout that are picking up the easy meals that are carried there by the current.
Yeah, so when you're talking about a meandering stream that has, you know, the more, you know, less turbulent water, I guess you could think of a lot of spring creeks as meandering streams as well.
Yeah, a lot of it is defined by, you know, the valley that the stream would go through. If it's a soft erodible valley, you know, more of a lower altitude type of a place, you're going to find a more meandering pattern. In higher altitudes with hard bottoms, you're going to find more of the riffle pool series.
Now, when as far as the fish are concerned, when you're having these meandering streams and the bends, and you've got the erosion taking place on the outside of that bend, you want to think, well, maybe that's where the fish are, but a lot of times we're fishing the inside of that bend as well. So where are the fish in that kind of situation?
Well, there's actually a cross current that occurs during when water moves around a bend in a river. It's water doesn't move uniformly as it tracks around a curve or a bend. It moves in a helical fashion, much like a barber pole. And it moves with the cross current that associates with that helical movement. There's a cross current at the surface that goes from the inner to the outer bank, and a cross current at the riverbed that comes from the outer bank to the inner bank. And so that cross current really dictates food distribution in and right after river bends. For that reason, I mean, anybody that's ever rode a drift boat always knows that you have to point the bow of the drift boat to the outer bank and row away from the outer bank, or that river will ground the boat into the outer bank. So you actually have to compensate for that cross current that's created. But that affects food distribution too. At the surface, you know, if you've got a spinner fall, you want to look for the accumulation of dead and crippled spinners on the along the outer bank. That's where the trout are going to be, you know, sipping dead insects. But if you're nymph fishing after after a bend in the river, look for that gravel bar that frequently accumulates, you know, along the inner bank, and then fish just at the drop-off after that gravel bar. That's
because
a great
with
place.
That helical pattern you're talking about of the flow of the water, so the water is actually can be taking insects and so forth from the outer bank, bringing them underneath, and then bringing them up on the inner side of the bend, I guess.
You're right. And a lot of times,
like a food delivery system.
It is. It's like a conveyor belt of food, and the trout will be, you know, a lot of times it does that with debris in there. There's a little gravel bar that sometimes develops right after the river bend, right along the inner bank, and boy, the trout can hold right at that drop-off because of that cross current bringing the food to them.
Well, Jason, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, let's dig into the first part of talking about currents and how they affect us on the surface and with the dry fly. So when we come back, we'll start digging into that. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net, or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Randall about Moving Water, a Fly Fisher's Guide to Current. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight.
I met Pudge at a fly fishing show, Roger. What a wonderful advocate for women in sports.
Oh, she's great. She's incredible. I've interviewed her a couple of times, and she's just a very warm and thoughtful person, and, yeah, a great advocate for fly fishing in general.
Yeah, definitely. My wife is the fly fishing enthusiast, and it's really nice to see women getting involved and loving the sport.
Well, she's a perfect one to model and use as a mentor, that's for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, tell us what's going on in your fly fishing world, Jason.
Well, you know, it's been pretty busy. I do get a chance to get out and fish quite a bit, which is kind of a nice fringe benefit, I think. I just got back from salmon fishing in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and we had a wonderful time up there. We've been going up with the same group of guys for probably 20 years or more, and you know, it's the company and the memories, and it's just as much as the fish, I think, that keeps us coming back. I just turned in the manuscript for the third book, which is the third in this trilogy. Feeding Time is the second, and Moving Water is the first. And I've got a little break, so I'm hoping to get, I'm going to get down to Puerto Rico next month and see if I can connect with a tarpon.
Ah, in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you?
I've been to Puerto Rico, never fished there, though.
No, I've been, but never fished either, so that's, it'll be the first.
It's an interesting island because, you know, on one side you've got a rainforest, and I hiked around in that, and on the other side it's like a desert.
Yeah, it's kind of like Washington by Seattle, huh?
Yeah, where all the rain collects on one side of the island, the other side's dry as bone, you know?
Yeah, I think Hawaii's like that, too. You know, I know we did a tour there one time, and that's a very diverse climate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you get down there, be sure to have, I think it's called Mofundo.
Oh, no. It sounds like a local drink.
No, it's food. Yeah,
okay.
Food made out of plantains, a stuffed mound of plantains, usually with meat inside. Very good.
Okay.
Very good.
So it sounds safe.
Well, good. Let's talk about currents and dry fly fishing, because there we're basically talking about two-dimensional river. Right?
Right. You know, and I think this is something that most fly fishermen are familiar with.
Right. And then we'll move on and talk about the three-dimensional river, as you call it. So, first of all, we have to talk about velocity and how it works in a river, right?
Right. Well, you know, I think at its very basics, rivers move because of gravity. You know, they move downhill, and so gravity is what sets the rivers and streams in motion. But friction is the opposing force that tends to retard or discourage the river in its downhill migration. And friction occurs then, if we look at the river's surface, it occurs at both banks. And so where there is friction close to the shore, that's going to be the zone of slowest moving current. And then as you move to the center part of the river, that water, unimpeded by friction, will be moving at the fastest speed. And then in between those, there's a kind of a slip current where there's a marked change between the two current zones.
So, and then you throw a bend in the river, and then that changes everything, right?
Yeah, definitely. Then it starts to get less uniform, and you start to get a lot more variation. But that flow, you know, that we typically see is called laminar flow, and there's a lot of things that disrupt laminar flow. As you indicated, river bends and things start to spiral the water, and so there are a lot of other factors.
So that change in velocity of the river affects us as fly fishers because of drag, which is our nemesis.
Yeah, the arch enemy.
Yeah. So, why don't you just kind of talk about maybe some different scenarios that we would encounter. And again, we're talking about surface fishing here because we're not involving the underlying currents that can, you know, the vertical currents that could change things as well. So give us some scenarios and talk about what the problem is and how we might solve it in our casting and bending.
Well, sure. Yeah, drag, I think, you know, to give it a definition, I think it's best defined as the unnatural influence or restriction of the natural free movement of an insect, or in our case, a fly, and it's caused by the leader or the line affecting or restricting the movement. And any time that we cast across multiple zones of currents and different current speeds, the line is going to pull or drag on the fly, and then it's going to spoil the presentation if we're trying to achieve a dead drift type of presentation. So I think since the beginning of the sport, there's been, you know, multiple adjustments that try to compensate for drag, trying to mend, stack mend, in-air mends, reach casts, all these types of things, all are designed with the same purpose, to try to eliminate drag.
Yeah, I know by the way, you either have a squeaky door or a squeaky chair.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure which.
I'll have to sit still.
Yeah. My last interview was with Jason Borger, and we were talking about skinny water, working in skinny water. And he was talking about, you know, the three things that benefit us most is those in-air mends.
Yeah.
And I think we all kind of know about, you know, doing mending on water, but those left, right, each cast, and up, down cast that allow us to do the stacking and pooling of line is is really valuable. Well, when we, you know, talking about a specific drag scenario, you know, let's talk about, you know, since we were talking about meandering streams and so forth, so I'm on the inside of a bend, and I've got basically slow water in front of me and the fastest water on the outside. How do I attack that problem?
Well, I think probably the thing that we most often overlook as anglers is angler position. You know, how can we move that can get us into a position where our line doesn't have to cross the competing currents? And I think trying to get our line to lay in only one current zone is probably the most effective way of defeating drag. So the first thing I would probably look at in that scenario is where could I move so that I don't have to cast across all these current seams.
In other words, maybe getting upstream and feeding down into it rather than going across current.
I think cross current is always going to be the most challenging, and I think no matter what our skill level as an angler, you know, we're always going to run into problems.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, in that movie, A River Runs Through It, when he catches that big trout. It's, as I remember, it's been a while since I watched the movie, but it seemed to me it was way on the other side of the stream. And
That's right, yeah. That's true to life, right?
Yeah, the cast you could never make, a presentation you could never make, you know.
Well, you could believe everything that you see in a movie or you read on the Internet.
Yeah. So, but I think a lot of times we attempt that.
Well, true. I think we do. You know, we see that tipping trout over there, and our first impulse is to, I can add 10 more feet to this cast, and I can put this right on top of them, and realize later that you really only have about maybe 2 feet of drag-free drift, and that you're not going to catch that fish.
Yeah, Mike in Virginia wrote in, and this is kind of more of a comment than a question, I guess. He says, my biggest problem is preventing drag due to varying velocity current, which is what we're talking about, between me and the fly. If I get more than a foot of drag-free float, I'm lucky. If I mend, I lose accuracy. Guess I need a lot more experience. So
that probably applies for all of us, though.
Yeah. So what other tips, other than positioning, could you give Mike?
Well, I think we probably covered most of them. You know, I think that obviously angler position is always, I think, the first thing that we need to just stop and take a minute. We have to look at maybe each rising fish or each, you know, lie that we're targeting, hoping that there is a fish there. We need to study that, you know, in a more analytic way and say, okay, I'm going to try to target this specific location. You know, at what position can I try to get to help me? And then once that's determined, I think then we have got to make those corrections. And I think it's crucial for us to make those corrections early in the game, making as many adjustments as we can before the fly hits the water with our in-air or casting corrections, and then mending before drag sets in. I think there's a very narrow corridor of time where you can effectively mend. If you already have a huge bow in your line, you're probably not going to effectively mend that without repositioning the fly and spoiling the whole presentation.
Right, and I think that the point Jason was making in the skinny water was that, you know, you in skinny water, you can't have a lot of splash. And, you know, doing a big bend on the water could scare off all the fish.
That's true.
And like Mike was saying, you know, I lose my accuracy. So it seems like one of the biggest things that we could do to improve is that in-air mend rather than on-the-water mend, which is, of course, much easier.
Yep, I think the earlier the correction is made, the more effective the presentation will be. You know, if you can make it before the cast is complete, I think that gives you a real advantage. And then if further mending is needed, then making it before drag has already put a big bow in your line is going to be a real advantage. But I think Mike addresses a very common situation for all of us. I mean, we all have the same limitations.
Okay, let's... Any other comments or suggestions or tips you'd want to give about working the current on the surface?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
Okay. Let's talk about the, as you call it, the three-dimensional river, which is where we start talking about nymphing. So now we've got the water working on the top, the currents working on the top. We also have what's going on underneath that's affecting our drift and our positioning and our accuracy, correct?
Correct. I think there's a lot more than meets the eye, for sure.
Well, you talk in your book a bit about the evolution of nymphing, and some of that relates to, you know, the challenges we face. Do you want to kind of, what's your take on where nymphing is at today?
Oh, boy, I think it's really progressed from, you know, perhaps the ugly stepsister to dry fly fishing advocates at the turn of the century to probably one of the most productive ways to consistently catch fish. I think there's a lot more subsurface feeding that occurs that we underestimate than what we can see from the surface. I think given the fact that most of the species that trout eat originate and reside and spend most of their time in the benthic layer, which is that community at the stream bed, I think that nymphing is probably the most consistent way to catch fish.
Okay. But what about the different methods that have
Well, I think, you know, if we look back to some of the forefathers, I mean, you can go back all the way back to Skewes and some of the people, the Brooks method. I think Brooks was and Sawyer and Leisenring were probably some of the first authors, anyway, to fully appreciate the, I think, some of the problems associated with nymph fishing. Brooks actually did allude to the vertical stratification of current velocities in rivers when he talked about some of his nymphing techniques, the Brooks method, and I think Sawyer, with his induced take, also kind of touched upon that, too, with some of the things that he was doing to try to initiate a strike, kind of feeding and teasing and dangling those flies in front of fish. And then Leisenring, with his lift, I think, also kind of underscored the importance of lifelike animation and activity to subsurface flies. And I think it's really been a solid foundation then that more current authors and guides and experts have kind of built upon, and it's evolved into some of the more popular techniques today, like some of the European style Czech nymphing and Polish nymphing and the high sticking and some of the tight line techniques that you see very commonly today. I think it's been a very marked progression as we've come to appreciate the complexities of current. Most of that is really trying to adapt to the vertical stratification of current and improve our presentation.
So am I reading into what you're saying is that it all works?
Yeah.
You need all of these things in your toolbox to...
I think so. I think, you know, to limit yourself to one technique is to put a limit on the number of fish you're going to catch. I think there's times and places for every technique, and I think the more tools you have in your toolbox, the more you'll get done.
Good. Well, let's take another quick break here, and then we'll come back and talk about, as you mentioned, vertical stratification, what that is and how it affects us. So we'll be right back. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com, that's K-I-E-N-E.com, or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jason Randall about Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Current. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, time to talk about vertical stratification. So not only do we have currents going back and forth across the top, but down below as well, right?
Exactly, and I think, you know, it's actually caused by the same forces that affect our dry fly fishing. It's caused by friction in how it affects water movement. At the surface, there's a small amount of friction created by the air-water interface. Sometimes this, in maybe slower water, is more dramatic. In faster, choppy water, white water, there isn't enough surface tension to create friction. But, you know, and many times there is that thin layer right at the surface of slightly slower moving water. Just below that, in the center part of the vertical column, the water is unaffected by friction, and you'll find the fastest current speed there relative to that section of the river you're looking at. And then as you get progressively closer to the bottom, the friction caused by the interface between the stream bed and the water gradually slows the water markedly to the point where the bottom couple centimeters of the river, even in fast water, is barely moving. And if you look at a vertical graph of what's called a vertical velocity profile, the bottom 25% of the river, regardless of the overall speed, the bottom 25% of the river is moving at about half speed, and the bottom 12% of the river, which would be 6 inches in a 4-foot run, is moving at 1/4 of the total speed of the river.
So if you're looking at the river as a cross-section, it's kind of like looking in the center of an onion, where pretty much the center is the fastest moving, and as you get further out to the edges, it has different variations of slowness.
Yeah, absolutely. A three-dimensional cross-section of the river would look like concentric rings of an onion, exactly, where at the surface and at the bottom and at each side of the shore, you're going to have the greatest effect by friction and the slowest water, and in the center of the onion is going to have the fastest water threat.
So, and we'll talk in a little bit about obstructions and so forth, which change everything in a different way, but let's say we have a river that's just as we talked about with no obstructions, and everything that you just talked about is going on. So I plop my nymph out there on a, let's say I'm running an indicator, and let's say I do have the proper depth. What's happening underneath my leader?
Well, just as our line lays across competing current seams on the surface, we expect our leader to pass below the strike indicator through zones of different current velocities to our flies, and it's going to have the same effect. If you cast across faster water to try to get your fly into slower water, the line is eventually going to assume the parabolic bow, and you're going to pull those flies fast and out of the soft water where you want them. The same happens vertically. Our flies are going to be pulled up from the stream bed where the fish are, and they're going to be accelerated to the fastest water that's in that section of the river. And our leader actually assumes the same parabolic bow below the strike indicator, a big curve down to the flies.
So how do you mend that?
Well, kind of the same thing. I mean, if you think about it, in order to correct the presentation, we have to introduce a small amount of slack, just like you do in the dry flies. We don't want to introduce too much slack, or we're never going to detect a strike, but you want to introduce enough slack to allow the flies to move unrestricted by the vertical drag and the pull of that leader. So if you stop the progress of the strike indicator and just hold it stationary, either by lifting it from the water and standing it still for a few seconds, it will allow the flies to continue to move beneath them, tumbling along the surface, introducing that slack. And then when you replace the strike indicator, you'll have a more natural presentation for a drift again until vertical drag once again spoils the presentation. I think perhaps that's probably the secret to these short upstream nymphing techniques like the European style and some of the newer styles is the presentations are short enough so that when the flies first land and go to the bottom, it takes a little while, just as it does in a dry fly, before the slack is removed and the drift is spoiled by drag. I think those presentations tend to be shorter, and I think the longest presentations, like those we make from drift boats, are probably the most susceptible to vertical drag, because we put them out there and we just watch them drift for 100 yards. And the whole time that they're drifting, you know, they're not looking as good as we think they are.
Oh, really? You know, I wondered about that, because I was going to bring up kind of the opposite observation I had once, which was fishing this run in the San Juan River down in New Mexico. And every time we went through this run with a drift boat, we'd pick up all kinds of fish and nymphing and just, you know, following along right next to the boat, same speed as the boat kind of thing. And then I went back and fished that same run from a flat that was next to it. So it was like a flat going out to a deep run and then a high bank on the other side. And I had a heck of a time trying to get my fly down to where the fish were for any length of time at all. And I caught very few fish from that point. And I also attributed it to the fact that, well, from the drift boat, I was getting it down deep, and it was staying down deep where the fish were for a longer period of time. And then when I went to the, you know, to the flat and fished it from waiting, I couldn't get it down there long enough to get a good drift deep enough. Well, so I don't know if my logic is flawed there or what. But that's kind
I don't think it is. You know, obviously you can't argue with the results that you saw. But I think maybe from a stationary position, especially if you're trying to cast, you know, further out into a run, you know, you're going to be presenting those flies only, you know, in a dead drift type of a presentation for a very short section. And then it's actually going to fish on a swing more like a wet fly, you know, as it starts to pull in the current. And I think maybe that, at least for that particular day, that wasn't what the trout were looking for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how do you recognize the vertical drag? Is there something we can see happen?
No, you don't. You don't really have the same clues that you do when you're dry fly fishing, because you can actually see the onset of drag and you can see the immediate result. But below the surface, it's really impossible to gauge. It depends a lot on, you know, the length of leader that you have below the strike indicator. It also depends a lot on the current speed. Faster current is going to result in a more rapid onset of vertical drag. And I think slower currents are going to be more gradual in the development of the drag. But I think correcting more frequently as a result, I think, is really the key. What I find myself doing now, I fish a lot different now from a drift boat than I used to. I start to target specific locations where usually I just flipped it out on one side and let it go. But if I see a boulder or a sweeper or a drop-off on the other side, I just flip sides. And then I'll pull the strike indicator back up river, back towards me a little bit, and I'll kind of feed those flies into those lies so that I know that I'm getting the best presentation to those prime lies. So I think I'm kind of trying to get a little bit of that tight line upstream style from a drift boat by feeding those flies to the trout.
Otherwise, what you kind of talked about this, but kind of walk us through, let's say we're not in a drift boat. Well, I guess the same thing would apply, but, you know, I'm making an up and across cast, nymphing. What do you do to mint? You know, how do you position the line?
If you're doing it up and across?
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of it depends on how far up and how far across. It's probably like dry fly fishing. I find myself using these longer style rods now. I've just got a 4-weight rod with that's probably 10.5 feet or something like that. And so I find that I can reach a lot more further across the river without having to cross, you know, the river itself. So I'm holding the rod up and away, and then just kind of rolling the stream so that I am trying to get those short drifts, but ideal presentations. I think that's the goal, is that long drifts from drift boats and long drifts across and up across current from stationary positions are probably not the ideal presentation. Probably see if you can get a little closer, that you can reach it with one of these long rods and try to do maybe an upstream approach, and then, you know, maybe shorten that cast if you can.
What about the vertical drag aspect? That's really what I was thinking more about. Is, you know, let's say my line is in the water, my indicator is on the surface. What can I do to counteract the vertical drag as it goes down?
Well, one of the things I've done to counter that effect is, if I'm trying to do maybe just a little bit longer presentation, is I will kind of flip it out and across and try to mend it, you know, right away, and then let it drift even to me. And then what I'll usually do at that point, because I know between the start of the drift and that point where it's directly opposite from where I'm standing, I know that vertical drag will probably set in and that drift is probably no longer effective. At that point, you can throw in a very aggressive upstream mend, lifting the strike indicator out of the water and actually pulling it a little bit upstream in the mending process. That will allow the flies again to sweep underneath it and kind of lead the strike indicator down the river, at least for the remainder of that drift. And the way I kind of, you know, started to notice that is I noticed that when I was doing that kind of cast, that most of my strikes occurred just at the very beginning of the drift, when the presentation actually looked real good. In the center of the drift, I wasn't attracting any fish, but at the end of the drift, I think partially due to Leisenring's lift, is where another time where I found that I was catching fish. Those were actually the two times in that total drift that I was probably actually appealing to trout. The rest of it looked probably unnatural to them.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well, you know. In fact, I've caught many fish untangling my line while
flies
downstream.
Definitely, the downstream dangle. But yeah, I think in my case, you know, when I started to notice that, it was probably the only time during that whole drift where I was actually tempting the trout. During the middle part of the drift where I thought it was drifting perfectly because I didn't see any drag on the strike indicator, but there was drag below the strike indicator, that point was not tempting very many trout.
Right. Well, a question came in from Charlie in Traverse City, Michigan. And he says, what's the best way to determine if the current is either too slow or too fast to swing a fly, which was what we were just talking about? Does it make any difference?
Well, I think it does. I think it's always best that our speed, you know, no matter what the presentation, whether it's a streamer or a dead drifting insect or the lift of nymphs at the end of the nymph drift or, you know, swinging on the wet flies, I think it always needs to mimic the natural speed that the insect would have. And so I think no insect has a jet ski, and so I think if it's going that fast, it's not going to really be too effective unless it's, you know, some type of a minnow or something that can really have a pretty good burst speed. But if an insect, they're not going to be, you know, that fast. And so I think if it's too fast for a natural lift, either swinging wet flies or, you know, at the end of a nymph where we're doing Leisenring's lift, at the end of the drift, I think you can let a little line pass through your hands as you're getting to that point, which will slow the swing or the lift of the flies.
Okay. Another question from Rob in Ridgewood, New Jersey. How does one effectively fish fast riffles and the associated current seams?
Well, I think that's a good question. It's a challenge in fly fishing. I love that aspect of fly fishing, the problem-solving kind of element that I think makes us use our head a little bit. But I think avoiding crossing, at least perpendicular to the current, avoiding as many different current seams as possible is always going to be a help. Angler position is probably still the best remedy, but identifying before you make your cast, identifying those problems and making the adjustments necessary, if you can get your line to cross as few competing current seams as possible, I think is best. It doesn't have to be perfectly up or downstream. I think if you can just move from a 90-degree angle perpendicular to a 45-degree angle, you'll find it's going to be a lot easier to give a good presentation.
Yeah, you keep coming back to that, you know, change your position, think about changing, and I think from tonight's conversation so far, I think that's, you know, probably the biggest tip that you've given folks is, you know, okay, you know, what's my best position? Get that first, and then maybe you've solved half your problem.
That's probably true. It reminds me of a story where that point was driven home to me. We were fishing on the Montana's Rock Creek, which, in my opinion, it should be named Slippery Rock Creek anyway, because I don't think anybody can wade it, you know, with any real safety anyway. But there was a trout rising on the opposite side of that, and I tried to cast to it, and I couldn't. You know, my fly was whisked out of the little backwater zone where he was feeding by the current, and no matter what I did, I couldn't get a long enough drift in there to get. So I crossed the creek, went downstream probably 100 yards or more to find a place where I could cross, came back up there, ended up catching the fish during a marvelous caddis hatch. It was the only fish I caught that night, and then by the time I crossed the stream again, it was dark, and I couldn't find the place where I crossed. I ended up swimming down the river, getting soaking wet, trying to find my way back to the car in dark, shivering. It was a lesson that came with a high price.
Yeah, yeah. Been there, too. Again, on the San Juan one night, it was getting dark right at that point, and I figured I better get back across the river. Same thing happened to me. I didn't take a swim, but my feet... My feet left the riverbed several times, you know, and I'm like floating for a little bit trying to find purchase. And
it's
I'm going,
not
oh,
a happy
I hope I'll kill my waders, but looks like you did the full Monty there.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. Yep.
Crawled up on the bank. At least there's no one there clapping their hands.
Yeah. Nick in Somerville, Massachusetts wrote in and he says, what's the best way to present a streamer or nymph in deep, swirling, complex eddies with lots of conflicting upstream and downstream currents. I know where a lot of those are.
Yeah.
Seems like they're ideal holding spots and for big fish because they churn up a lot of food. But they sure are a pain in the neck to fish.
Oh, that's true. That's a good question. It really illustrates a very real problem. I think the biggest thing is you don't know where your fly is. I remember one night I was fishing with a friend and we were hex fishing at night and it was pitch black and there was a rising fish in an area like that where there was many competing currents and he cast out there and he was watching and listening where he thought his fly was and a fish sucked over here, big sucking slurp, weighed to our left, and we found out it was his fly. He was convinced that it wasn't because it was never where we thought it was. And in the night, that's going to happen even on surface flies. But nymph fishing, that's going to happen during the day as well. You just don't know where your fly is because of the competing currents. And so I think the best remedy for that is to try to keep as tight a line and, you know, as little amount of slack as possible. Try to use more of a tight line technique without spoiling the presentation, but you can even lead the flies a bit so that you maintain just a little bit of contact with them. And definitely don't rely on the strike indicator. I mean, it's not going to be a very accurate indicator of trout striking.
Dan in Illinois wrote in and he says, fishing currents in unfamiliar waters, is it better to begin with floating fly line and dry flies or sinking line? I think what he's trying to do is figure out what the current's doing there.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's hard to really determine from the surface what the current might be doing under the surface. And I think the way that, at least the way I see the question is, you know, it really depends on a lot of different variables. I think it really is based on your specific goals. You know, are you fishing for one large trophy fish? You're trying to have some fun catching a lot of nice-sized or medium-sized fish, because I think that's really going to dictate your fishing strategy, whether you're going to use dry flies or maybe a sinking line, you know, with a streamer or something like that. Because as fish grow from small to medium to large, they change their feeding habits quite a bit. You know, they move from initially feeding on very small organisms off the drift to feeding on larger types of meat-eating type of a diet, and they have a whole different feeding pattern. So I think it depends on really what your goals are. I'm really asked a lot by anglers. I had one guy ask me to show. He says, I never seem to catch the fish that I see on the covers of magazines. But when I asked him his favorite style of fishing, he said, I like to throw dry flies and nymphs. And he said, but all I seem to catch are these 14 to 16-inch fish. And I said, you have any marvelous experience because you're fishing with a fishing strategy that specifically targets those fish, the fish that are in the medium-sized category that are feeding from the drift of insects and organisms in the stream. If you want to catch the trophy fish, you know, they're meat eaters, and they have a whole different diet and feeding behavior. You kind of have to specifically target those types of fish. We kind of get into that in the book that was just released, Feeding Time, where it really discusses and analyzes feeding behaviors and diets according to life stages.
Yeah, good point, good point. I know, you know, Bill Edrington, who we interviewed and talked about the Arkansas River and talking about brown trout, you know, it was time of day down there. He says,
definitely.
Everybody wants to get out here first thing in the morning. He says, forget that. Go have breakfast. Have a nice omelet, bacon, sausage. Get out on the river about 11 o'clock in the morning, but stay out till about 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah. There you go. Know,
that's where the big fish, they're out there feeding after that sun starts to go down.
Yeah, they're low-light feeders. Yeah, they're going to come out and they're going to be hungry, you know, at that point in the evening.
But, I, you know, you think about those things. And I remember my dad was always, you know, my dad would say, okay, we got to go fishing tomorrow. We're going to be up at like 5 o'clock and ready to roll at 5:30. And, you know,
like, sounds like my dad. He was a bass fisherman. And
I was too.
Shivering in an aluminum boat at 5:30 in the morning before daybrank eating.
Yeah, before you knew how to drink coffee, right?
Yeah, and gas station. Yeah, gas station hot chocolate, I think.
Yeah. So good memories, though. Well, listen, we'll take another quick break here, and then we'll come back, and we're going to dig into a long description and question from Davy Wooten, who also has been on our show several times. So we'll come back and address Davy's question here in a minute. Rogue Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado, located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. And by the way, that's Bill Edrington's shop that I was just talking about, fishing the Arkansas.
There you go.
That a coincidence that they ran together there. Okay. Davey wrote in, and Davey's a great fly fisher with a lot of experience, especially we did a great show with him on wet fly fishing. And so if you haven't listened to that one in our archive, I'd highly recommend listening to that. But Davey wrote in, and he says, so he's going to describe some things here, so stick with me and pay attention here. The primary influence of downstream drift is determined by surface movement, fly line, indicator of the fly. That factor cannot be changed unless the angler does not have good surface drift control related to the relative control of the fly line related to the surface movement. For there is no way the angler can determine issues related to the subsurface hydraulics. And that's kind of what you were just talking about, Jason, when you said, well, you know, how can you see that?
That's
true.
You know,
the drag underneath, because we can't really see what hydraulics are. We can kind of guess, I guess, but we don't have a lot of control, right?
Right.
So he says, the main issue of concern to the angler to maintain effective presentation value are determined by depth and speed of the water, relative length of leader/tippet section from indicator to fly, and C, the addition of weight is needed more than the fly. And D, the method of fishing, indicator versus like EU style. So he says, my observations after 40 years of guiding an average of 200 days in the water are simply this. The most common error is assuming that you need 1.5 times water depth from indicator to fly. So that's a nonsense way of thought. How would you know the depth of the water unless you wade it out to check it out? And in many cases, you cannot. Length of leader from indicator to fly should be based on water depth and speed. Slow water less, faster water much greater, given additional weight if needed. So his question is, given that preface, is what is your approach, Jason? Davey went through all the issues we face.
Pretty much. There's enough information that he's sharing here to make another book or at least a good magazine article. Wow.
But, you know, when you walk through those, talking about, A, depth and speed of water.
Sure.
Yeah.
All
I mean,
good points.
The deeper, you have more complexity, I would think.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and there's probably not much that Davey Wooten doesn't know about trout and fly fishing already, but
yeah,
I'll give it a try anyway.
Okay.
Pretty much, I think everything that he says and states it in the preface is really pretty much on target based about what we know about vertical velocity, stratification, and currents. You know, I think that, again, he indicates the European-style fishing that really uses a lot of sighters instead of suspension devices like strike indicators and the shorter upstream cast and compensation for current. And I agree with that completely. But my approach to answer his question is, you know, I think one of the most common problems for us when we nymph fish is exactly what he says. We set the rig at the beginning, including the depth of the strike indicator, and then we forget about it. We never change as the river changes depths or current speeds. Oftentimes we don't consider adding weight when we know that in faster water, I mean, we need more weight to get and keep our flies on the bottom. And I don't think we adjust that enough. Steelhead fishermen, since I'm in the Midwest, you know, I do a lot of steelhead fishing, and we know that we have got to put a lot of weight to maintain contact with the bottom in faster water. That lifting force from vertical drag and the accelerating force wants to pull our flies up into the main body of the current following the fly line. And if we're going to compensate for that, think how much weight you've got to put on that in fast water to maintain contact with the bottom. I think we need to feel the bottom once in a while. I like to have a snag once in a while, or at least get on a rock. I know that I'm close to the bottom or on the bottom. And I think sometimes we forget that. You know, and I think, you know, being creative
is probably not just throwing out the strike indicator from a boat and just watching it drift, not doing anything. As long as the strike indicator seems to be floating along, we assume that our flies are at a dead drift too, but in fact they're probably not. So I really do a lot more, I'm a lot more active with it. That kind of fishing is more like, you know, like trolling for salmon, you know, where you just kind of lay the rig out there and sit down and have a beer. I'm a lot more interactive with it now. I'm trying to target specific lies. I'm trying to feed my flies to those lies. I'm switching sides a lot more, and I think it's really made me a better fisherman.
Yeah, and I guess it's, you know, I forget who said that, you know, you keep doing, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results.
That's true.
I think we do that a lot in fly fishing. I know I do. You know, mm-hmm. You get stuck in a rut and you keep doing it, and an hour later you go, God, I haven't caught any fish.
Yeah.
You really ask yourself, well, have you done anything different in the past hour? You've been doing the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, probably been doing the same thing. Well, maybe you better change something up.
And, yeah, sometimes we get lulled to sleep.
Yeah, and lazy, you know? It's like,
yeah.
You know, I don't want to wait out there, or I don't
yeah.
want to change up my fly. It's going to take me 15 minutes at my age to change up my fly.
Or you got to haul it all in and move the strike indicator and add a little more weight or take a little bit more weight off. And, you know, a lot of those European techniques now are they're using anchor flies, which is one, oftentimes it's a tungsten weighted fly that really its primary purpose is to pull the rest of the flies down to the bottom. I mean, it's still, you can still catch fish off the anchor fly too. It's designed to try to be, you know, a fish attractor as well, but you really, it's trying to get those flies to the bottom and keep
right,
them there.
Right. In your book, you talk a little bit about turbulence. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, what we all certainly know about turbulence, and how can turbulence help us find fish or catch fish or knowing about it?
It introduces variation into the river, certainly. You know, turbulence is like, you know, you think of white water and that type of thing. It can create habitat and disrupt normal current flows through the river. But the real benefit of turbulence is it's really where oxygen enters the river, especially in the summer. Areas of turbulence is where there's admixture of gases into the water, and that's really what gives white water its white appearance and opacity is air bubbles. So in the summer river where the water temperatures may be high and oxygen may be low, you know, turbulence can sometimes be right where the trout are, just downriver. So you look at a real fast water rip and run, puts a lot of oxygen in the water, and it dumps it into a pool. And a lot of times the trout are going to be holding at the back edge of that pool, you know, in the higher oxygen, you know, and taking advantage of the food that's being delivered to them as well.
Okay. So look for places right below highly oxygenated water.
Yeah, especially in the summer. The summer, the warmer water doesn't carry oxygen as long as colder water, and the saturation of oxygen is different. So, you know, oxygen is a big limiting factor for summer fishing and summer feeding patterns for trout.
Okay, let's about have time here. We only have about 9 minutes to go here on our questions. Let's talk about some strategies that you talk about in your book. One, you mentioned three of them here, so I thought we'd run through them. One was drop-offs. So describe a drop-off to us, and then, you know, maybe a strategy for fishing a drop-off, considering the currents involved.
Well, drop-offs, I think, are oftentimes a prime fish lies. I think you'll find some of the bigger fish holding at drop-offs. Drop-offs are depth changes where maybe a 2-foot section all of a sudden drops off and becomes a 6-foot section of the river. There's a very marked and abrupt change in depth. I think the most common point of drop-off is where a real fast riffle or run empties into a pool. And a lot of times there's a current thread that kind of extends into the pool of faster water. But below that, at the drop-off, those fish will be kind of underneath that tongue of fast current, and as the food drops out of the faster water as it flows, those fish are just going to be gobbling up the feeding opportunities there, and sometimes that will be the bigger fish at the head of those pools. The biggest challenge, I think, for us when we're trying to fish a drop-off is, one, is trying to get our flies to not have natural influence of the leader, not have vertical drag, and to actually drop out then into the slower water where the fish are going to gobble them up. And I think then the second biggest consideration is how are we going to detect the strike if we have enough slack in our line or leader to allow them to drop. So I think those are the two biggest challenges in fishing drop-offs. And I think kind of keeping a semi-tight line, allowing and kind of feeding the flies as they drop through there, but not keeping so much tension on the line that we're spoiling the natural drift.
Okay. And this is such a common one for me, I know, is the midstream obstructions. You know, you've got that rock out in the middle, and you know there's fish either above or below it.
Mm-hmm.
But always a tough one to try to position your fly and also to get it at the right depth and know where it's at, like you said before.
Yeah, that's true. I think there's two common types of midstream obstructions, I think. The one is a subsurface boulder that you can only identify on the surface by a boil that you see. The water is kind of creating a small hydraulic effect on the surface that indicates that there's a subsurface boulder. Then there's obviously the one you can see. But again, these are good feeding sites, but there's a lot of competing currents around these as well. And I think one of the challenges here is probably knowing where your flies are. I know I was fishing on the Bighorn 2 years ago, and I had marked a fish, you know, and I could see him holding in relatively clear water, kind of off to the side of an obstruction, and I cast to him, and I thought, well, I missed the cast because it was a little too far over, and I don't think my fly is close enough to him, and then the trout blinks, you know, I could see the white of the mouth opening, and then I paused for a second, and of course, the pause is deadly. And I just lifted to set the hook just a half a second too late because I felt him on for a second, and he was gone. But the different currents and the competing currents around obstructions means you don't always know where your fly is again. And if you do have a sight-marked fish and you do see a visual indication of strike, set the hook because it very well could be and probably is your fly.
Okay. Is there, you know, when you've got this, let's say it's above water, midstream obstruction, you know, rock out there, where do you figure most of the, you know, I mean, I've seen fish in front of the rock, which
mm-hmm.
is usually easier to get to them there, I think, where you assume that they are behind the rock or in the seam behind the rock. Where do you find fish more often?
Well, there is a pocket of or a cushion of soft water that bounces back off the obstruction that creates a back eddy or a recirculating eddy of soft water in front of the obstruction. And a lot of times you'll see fish holding right in front of there. You can also fish the trailing edge of either side of the obstruction or immediately right behind. There's also oftentimes a recirculating back eddy. It creates what a biologist would call a depositional microhabitat, which is a big word for kind of a garbage can of the river where things get dumped. A lot of times what gets dumped there is food. And you have a lot of organisms that really favor these depositional microhabitats like scuds. They're real common in these types of pocket water back eddies. Matter of fact, a lot of those European style fishing, you know, I first got my first flies that I ordered when that first became popular, they all look like scuds. It's amazing how many of those Czech nymphs look like good scud imitations, and really that's what it is. You're in pocket water. Those are depositional microhabitats, catch basins, if you will, of the ecosystem, and a lot of stuff gets dumped there. And so you don't want to overlook that. So really when I looked at a midstream obstruction, I'm trying to identify all the potential feeding lies, and then you're going to try to fish to each one individually. If I'm from a stationary position, I'll start below and fish my way up the seams back and forth, hitting each trailing edge, the right and left trailing edge off the obstruction, and then the area right behind the obstruction. And then I'll move slightly abreast to the obstruction, and I'll try to fish that pocket cushion right in front of the obstruction.
Okay, so you usually approach it from downstream.
I usually do, yeah. I think that's, unless there's a reason I can't get downstream of it, I will try to fish downstream from a downstream position working up.
Okay. And then lastly, talked about sweepers. What's a sweeper, and then how would you fish a sweeper?
Well, a sweeper might be something that redirects current at an angle. So you're looking at like a log or a treetop or branches that are laying in the river that are usually at a downstream angle that kind of funnel food and current then into a specific or narrower zone within the river. And those are, again, really good prime lies for big trout because the food is concentrated into a narrower zone. And I think either just after or downstream of the sweeper, that seam that's created is a great place to find trout. But also in front of the sweeper, there's going to be the same kind of effect. You're going to get some current interactions, and you can catch fish right along the front edge of sweepers as well on logs. A lot of times, too, the current is remodeling all the time. The water movement remodels. And so a lot of times it will excavate small channels underneath the sweeper or log, and you'll actually have little tunnels essentially created under there, and sometimes those can be really great places for trout to hole up. I think a lot of times too, if we're fishing the front edge of a sweeper, because our strike indicator is usually forward and then our nymph flies are usually trailing behind the indicator, a lot of times by the time our strike indicator gets to the sweeper, we pull back and correct and recast, but our flies never even got close to the feeding lies because they might have been 2 feet trailing behind the strike indicator. So what you need to do is you need to stop the strike indicator before you recast, hold it there for just a moment, and allow the flies to swing underneath the strike indicator and actually present to those fish that are there.
Oh, interesting. Good tip. Well, Jason, we've run out of time, so we need to cut off our questions here. Let me just double check. Looks like we're good to go. So we do have a couple things that we still need to take care of, and some of that is giving away prizes. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And also a copy of your book, Jason, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, thanks to Stackpole Books. So we'll be right back, and we'll do just that and give away some great prizes. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaskan history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where a successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal Strip Mine. For more information on how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org. That's www.inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Okay, well, now it's time to give away some prizes. And the winners for our drawings that are randomly selected from our show's registration database, and if you didn't register for that yet, it's a little late now, but make sure you do so on our next show, because we're always giving away some of these great prizes. Now, if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and get the information we need on how to get you your gifts. So that's how we'll handle that. And so the first thing we're going to give away here is a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And it's a great organization to support. So if you're one of the lucky winners, it'll be a good introduction and way to start out. And let's see, our winner for that is Bill Dahlquist in Minnesota. So, Bill, congratulations, and we'll take care of you and get your membership going. And we should have your email address, and I'll contact you on what I need. And then our second prize to give away tonight for our drawing is a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. That's www.amatobooks.com. And so our winner there is Stephen Bodenstab. Not sure how to pronounce it. And he's in Illinois, so congratulations, Stephen. Got yourself a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, thanks to Amato Books. Okay, so now, Jason, need to give away a copy of your book. And let me just make sure my cue. And so now, to win this book, you're going to have to answer the question I'm going to ask here at the end. Use that text box on our homepage. Put in your answer, your name and location, and submit your your answer, and the first person that gets it right will win Jason's book, Moving Water, Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Find out more about what Stackpole has to offer, go to stackpolebooks.com, stackpolebooks.com. They publish a lot of great, great fly fishing books. Okay, so the question's going to be easy tonight. The question's going to be, what's one of the, if you're going to try to beat out drag, whether it's vertical or across the horizontal surface, what is one of the first things we talked about tonight that you might want to do to get less drag? And it applies to both situations. One of the first things you might want to do. Interesting. I haven't seen any little question thing just isn't working here. Just waiting for an answer. Oh, yeah, okay. Reduce tippet size. Quite what I was looking for, would Jason?
No, I don't think that's going to help, but I don't think that's the answer you're looking for.
Reach cast. I think that's what I'm looking for either.
It does. It does help.
It helps, but you know what I'm looking for, right?
I know what you're looking for.
Okay. Okay, keep going, guys. We talked about it. In fact, we even highlighted it, and I said, hey, that's probably the one big tip that we keep talking about.
And it's one you can do without even holding the rod.
There you go. Okay. Come on, guys. Gals. Nice book. You guys taking a long time tonight. I thought that was going to be an easy one.
Yeah, I thought that wouldn't be too bad.
Okay, nobody's coming in with answers here. I guess I'm going to keep the book for myself. Mend? No. Dick, not a mend. Really simple thing. What can you do to get a better drift no matter whether you're going cross current, up current, whatever? You got to do something first before you even cast. That's about as big a hint as I can get. I think we got one here.
All right.
How about reposition the angler? Which
there
you
go.
You. Yeah.
We have a winner.
Yourself. So, Mike, I don't know. Mike, you got a last name there? You'll need to send that over to me. Also, Mike, in that same text box, send over your mailing address because we'll need that to send you your book. But
congratulations, Mike.
Mike at elegantphotograph.com, email address there. So he had submitted an answer earlier. But good. Well, congratulations, Mike. Mike, and send me over that information. We'll get you taken care of and get that book out to you. So I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Well, Jason, thanks so much for being on the show with us tonight. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate being here with you tonight, Roger.
Yeah, it was lots of fun, and of course, we always like talking about fly fishing, so always a great time.
You bet.
Well, hopefully, all of you have found the archive on our website. If you haven't, there's a couple of links on it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page, so go to the archive and search our past shows. We've got over 170 shows now there. You can find information about anything you want about fly fishing. And lots of great stuff to learn, and you can search by keyword phrase to find whatever you want. So check it out, and I think you'll be impressed and pleasantly surprised at what you discover there. Our next broadcast will be on November 6th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to interview Brian Chan, and our topic for the show will be fall stillwater tactics, so something quite different than currents. No currents. So join us. Brian Chans, he's an expert on fly fishing still waters. I know you've had probably listened to him on our other shows. And we're going to explore the challenges and the opportunities that present themselves in fishing still waters in the fall. So join us then. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Royal Gorge Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.